Stay tuned for a Juneau Afternoon. We'll talk with Andrew Bogar and Michelle Brown about the Emergency Preparedness Expo. We'll get the details about SEAC's Herbert Glacier Bike and Hike. We'll take in the fourth installment of Midnight Oil and learn more about how the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline has affected our state, and we'll learn about the upcoming Rotary Brewfest. Taking a look at the extended forecast, sunny for the rest of today, tomorrow, and mostly sunny on Thursday, with temperatures between 68 and 71, changing to partly cloudy on Friday, dropping down to about 64. Stay tuned.
This is National 8 of News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Hearings continue for the second day in Nebraska, where that state's Public Service Commission is considering the Keystone XL oil pipeline proposal. Nebraska's approval is a key component of pipeline company Trans-Alaska's plan to ultimately build a 1,200-mile oil pipeline from Alberta to an existing pipeline in Steele City, Nebraska. The proposal requires state permits, and residents, landowners, and business interests are divided over whether it's a good idea or not. Among those closely watching the hearings is Joy Braun from the Indigenous Environmental Network. The organization helped organize a rally and march opposing the pipeline at the site of this week's hearings in Lincoln. Braun says, like the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock, the consultation issue weighs heavily with the Keystone Project.
We're supposed to have free, prior, informed consent when any of these projects go through, and they haven't done that. They certainly haven't done it with my tribe, which is the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And, you know, this is all 1851, 1868 treaty territory. The Yankton Sioux Tribe, he is an intervener in the Nebraska State Public Service Commission hearings. They haven't consulted them. They haven't consulted Omaha. They haven't consulted Winnebago or the Poncos. So, yeah, this is a big deal.
Braun says tribes have a stake in the land going back to 1851 and 1868 Fort Laramie treaties. She also says tribes and others have concerns about potential contamination of the vast Oglala Aquifer under much of Nebraska and several other states that provides water for hundreds of thousands of people. Braun says so far her organization is keeping a relatively low profile, letting the administrative and legal proceedings play out. President Barack Obama killed the Keystone Pipeline proposal, but President Donald Trump revived it, saying it promises jobs and increases commerce. Following the week of hearings, the Public Service Commission will continue to take written comments. A decision could come as late as November. Some liquor store owners near the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota say they're seeing a jump in sales since the forced closure of beer stores in the tiny town of White Clay, Nebraska. One store owner in Ulrich, South Dakota, tells Rapid City TV station KOTA that monthly sales doubled to $60,000 following the April closure of the White Clay stores. Ulrich's is just west of Pine Ridge, which prohibits alcohol sales. The station talked to several other stores that also saw a hike in sales. Just days after officials said they would reconsider damage claims over the 2015 Gold King mine spill, the U.S. Environmental Agency now says it won't reconsider the previously rejected $162 million claim by the Navajo Nation. The agency says the tribe's suit against it prevents it from reopening their claim. On the second anniversary of the spill, EPA Chief Scott Pruitt visited the Gold King mine site and said the Obama administration failed to adequately protect those downstream. He promised a review of the mitigation claims by tribes, agencies, and governments. The EPA issued a statement Monday saying the Navajo Nation and the state of New Mexico both cannot be reconsidered because of pending litigation. Navajo Nation leaders signed in a new law Monday, making human trafficking a criminal offense on the reservation. The new law changes the tribe's code, giving tribal courts authority to prosecute human trafficking cases against both members and non-members who violate the law within the Navajo boundaries. Those convicted can receive up to a year in jail or a $5,000 fine, or both. It defines human trafficking as someone who recruits, solicits, or transports another person with the intent to force or coerce that person into labor or engaging in sexual activity for money. The tribal council passed the resolution last month. Backers of the measure say it's in response to a perception that opportunistic individuals are exploiting naive and impressionable Native youth, especially girls, and forcing them into prostitution. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com. Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, and with me on the board is our producer, Jeff Brown. My first guest today is Bryn Fluharty. She is the communications coordinator for SEAC, which stands for Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. They have been doing environmental work in this region for 47 years. And Bryn's going to tell us about this Saturday morning's Herbert Glacier bike and hike. Welcome, Bryn. Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, let's hope the raindrops hold, although you said 80 people showed up in a downpour for the Perseverance event some time ago. So Junoites are not held back, I guess, by a little liquid.
It would be pretty hard to live in Southeast and be held back by the rain.
So what's up this Saturday?
So this Saturday we have a, as you said, a bike and hike. So that means that we will have both bikers and hikers going out to the Herbert Glacier. There we're going to be learning about both the history of the areas, so the ecology and geology and hydrology of the area, and also the mining history in the area, and what the current proposed changes to the mining ordinance here in the city and borough of Juneau might mean for the Herbert Glacier area.
How long a hike bike is that? About 4.5 miles one way, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a total of about 10 miles round trip, so...
And this will be a round trip, no staying overnight at the cabin.
No staying overnight, unfortunately.
And at what time should folks meet?
So for the hikers, they will meet at the Herbert Glacier Trailhead at 10 o'clock a.m., and then if you want a bike, at 11:30, same place.
And is that at about 27 mile or thereabouts?
Yeah, 27, 28 mile.
And folks will see a lot of cars, I would assume, there on the right-hand side as they go out the road.
Yeah, and we'll probably have our SEAC sign up as well.
Talk a little bit about the mining history, if you can, in that area.
You know, one of the most interesting parts of it is that there's always been exploration out there. There's always been an interest. Right now they're doing additional exploration. And what's going to be really interesting is to see how climate change actually affects the area, because certainly historically the glacier has been lower down. It's one of the slower receding glaciers in the area, but what we're seeing is that climate change might actually open up some new ground for mining and new discussions around that.
Are we talking about gold mining?
Yes.
What other potentially valuable minerals are out there? Do you know?
You know, I'm not sure about this particular mine. I know that they're specifically looking for gold right now.
And there is already a mine there, or an adit, or a tunnel?
They have some mining claims out there, but there's no actual established mine.
Do you know if it was the Herbert Glacier, the Herbert Glacier area, where I know that there was a family that did gold mining out there and used a rail system, a rail car with a rail bed, to bring the crushed rock or the rock in to be crushed? Do you have some information on who operated the claims out there?
You know, I am not sure about that specific question. Our water expert in our office, Guy Archibald, is going to be the one who is doing the hike and who's actually explaining a lot more about the history and about the science behind everything out there.
Is there some concern about the review of the mining ordinance right now? Has there been some analysis of how that could impact that Herbert River Glacier area?
So the mining ordinance, the proposed changes essentially gut the ordinance and would take out a lot of the public participation and environmental review. So we're doing a lot of work to look at the proposed changes and see exactly how it would impact, but we do know that it would make it easier for mining claims to be opened, so that's why we talk about Herbert Glacier, which would be impacted. They wouldn't be, if the proposed changes go through, they wouldn't be as regulated as they would be under the mining ordinance that we have currently, and it wouldn't be subject to as much public participation.
What's the timing of the consideration of this ordinance?
Right now, they are looking at a couple of different things, but we're not going to see any meetings the next couple of months is what we're thinking right now.
I'm sorry, did you say there would not be meetings for the next couple of months?
Correct. We've had a couple of assembly meetings, and it's gone to a small committee in the assembly, and then they will be they'll be going and looking at a couple of different regulatory questions.
So now would be the time for the public to pay attention as it is in development to better understand it and to gauge how it would affect potential claims or existing claims here in the Juneau area. It seems like we're fairly early in the process then.
Yeah, it's definitely a great time for people to speak up, to get in touch with the assembly, and to really have their voice heard. It would have a pretty big impact. Any mine would have a pretty big impact. A mine out at the Herbert Glacier would impact a lot of our recreation. We've got a couple of cabins out there, like the Eagle Glacier Cabin, and so a lot of that recreation and the trail system would be impacted. And then also the AJ mine would be under that jurisdiction as well. And so that's one of our concerns, especially because that is right in the Gold Creek watershed where we get all of our drinking water for downtown.
SEAC, I know, has been doing work in this region regarding conservation and environmental protection for nearly a half a century now. What are some of the other issues that SEAC is paying attention to, and does it include all of Southeast Alaska? Give us a taste of what else is going on that SEAC is working on.
We do work throughout Southeast Alaska, and we make sure to get out to all of our communities and pay attention to a lot of different issues going on. We're a grassroots organization, so we get the word out about different projects that are going on that would impact the Tongass and then the Inside Passage waters. Some of the things that we focus on are stopping old-growth clear-cut logging on the Tongass. It's a very small sector of our economy right now and threatens what is our mainstay centers of our economy, which are fishing and tourism. And we also talk a lot about mining and clean water. And so taking a hard look at some of the mines in the region and making sure that hopefully we can get some safeguards in place to help keep our salmon and our water safe.
What is the role of federal EPA regulation in terms of positioning with whatever local ordinance might be developed? Is there an overlay of federal jurisdiction even on top of such an ordinance?
So if are you referring to the claims that it's a duplicative process for the CBJ mining ordinance?
Yes, correct.
So what's going on there is that the mining ordinance actually, it allows for any sort of duplicative process to not be required under the ordinance. And so if there is duplication, then you don't actually see that having to be done a second time. What it is that it's a safeguard. So where there is a gap between state and federal regulations, the CBJ mining ordinance is able to help ensure that we do actually have those safeguards.
So it would be a bridge then to fill in those areas not already addressed at the other two levels, state or federal.
Yes.
I understand. How closely does SEAC work with Native organizations in Southeast Alaska? The Sea Alaska owns the surface rights to tens of thousands of acres of timber, and while clear cut is not as prevalent as it was, say, 35 or 40 years ago, some of it is happening on private land. How does SEAC work with private organizations in this region?
We work on an individual basis with different projects and with different organizations. It really depends on the project. We have people in our office that are dedicated to doing outreach to various communities, including Native communities in the area, but it really depends on the project.
And are there cross-boundary issues with Canada that SEAC works on as well, in as much as so much of Southeast Alaska's panhandle lays along Canada?
That's primarily in the mining sphere, and so one of our biggest concerns is that a transboundary mine would have some sort of failure. So we see issues with mines like the Tulsico Chief, and then mines like the Mount Polly mine that's in central BC, which actually last Friday was the three-year anniversary of a tailings dam collapse there. And while that didn't actually go into a river that has an output in southeast, it is a pretty good example of what can happen if a disaster does occur.
We're talking with Bryn Fluharty. She is the communications coordinator of SEAC, and we started talking about an event this Saturday morning, which is a bike and hike to Herbert Glacier. If you would like to hike the trail, which is at about 26, 27 mile, look for the signs, show up at 10. And if you'd like to bike it, show up at 11:30. And is it free, or is this a fundraiser of some sort, Bryn?
It's completely free.
And about how long should people budget to get out there, to listen to the information, and to get back? Is it an all-day type of event?
You know, we estimate that for bikers it'll take about an hour and a half each way, with about 45 minutes in between for talking, and then for hikers another maybe 2 hours on top of that.
And if someone wanted to find out more information about the event or SEAC's work on the proposed mining ordinance or other issues, where can they take a look?
They can go to our website. It's www.seacc.org.
SEACC.org. Thanks for joining us, Bryn.
Thank you.
This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is taking a deep dive into the history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, looking at how it shaped our state. We're telling that story in an 8-episode podcast. Today, we're presenting episode 4 on the radio. No download required. It was produced by Energy Desk reporters Elizabeth Harbaugh, Rasha McChesney, and Zoe Sobel. Here's Elizabeth to start things off.
In the spring of 1974, an airplane dropped Dave Haugen at a camp 5 miles north of the Yukon River, smack dab in the middle of Alaska. His job? To oversee construction of the road that would run along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Haugen was only on the job a week or two when, on his watch, a bulldozer worth maybe a couple $100,000 caught fire.
And I can see my whole career going up literally in smoke.
Haugen was sure the burning bulldozer spelled the end of his pipeline building career. And on any other project, it probably would have. But when he called headquarters to report it...
I'll never forget his instructions. He says, well, if it's in the way, push it over the side and keep moving.
That told Haugen everything he needed to know. Despite the fact that building the pipeline would require an army of workers, toiling in treacherous conditions and pose engineering challenges that didn't yet have solutions, keep moving was the message Haugen and everyone else building the pipeline would get every day until it was finished. Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh.
I'm Rasha McChesney.
And I'm Zoe Sobel. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state.
On today's episode, an exercise in superlatives.
We're talking about the largest privately funded construction project in the world.
Built across the biggest U.S. state, faced with unprecedented natural obstacles.
And an ever-growing price tag.
That's right. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which became so famous during construction, they even made a movie about it, starring soul icon Gladys Knight.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at OurAKSpirit.com. with additional support from NPR Story Lab.
One of the first things you notice when you walk into Haugen's Anchorage office, he works for the state of Alaska nowadays, is a human-sized cartoon cutout of a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I'm called a dinosaur since I've been around for that many years.
Haugen doesn't seem bothered by the nickname. Actually, Haugen doesn't seem bothered by much. He has kind of a zen vibe.
That probably came in handy during his time working on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. He was a project manager for the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, formed in 1970 by a group of oil companies that had gotten lucky, unbelievably lucky, on Alaska's North Slope. Almost immediately after oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay in 1968, they drew up plans for a pipeline to get that oil to market. And this was no small task. The back of the envelope estimate was that a pipeline would cost $900 million. That seemed like a hefty sum at the time, until it became clear what they were budgeting for.
The proposed 800-mile pipeline route from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez will encounter every type of condition and terrain Alaska has to offer.
These grand plans were stalled for more than 5 years by environmental lawsuits and Alaska Native claims to the land. But in 1974, they finally got the go-ahead, and Alyeska had no time to wait. It had already poured a ton of money into the project. So the oil companies had a crystal-clear message for guys like Haugen. Even if the temperatures plummeted, the workers complained, or bulldozers burned, keep moving.
What all of us knew about as managers of the project is what we can't have happen is this cannot slip. You must get this done on time.
The standard schedule for the workers was 7/12s, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Haugen says it was the most grueling work schedule many of them had ever endured. And during his first few weeks, he started to feel overwhelmed. The project he was ostensibly helping to manage was so huge, he couldn't keep track of everything that was going on. Haugen decided that if he was going to get through it, he had to come up with a mantra.
And I finally actually had to sit myself almost literally in the corner and talk to myself. And what I came up with was, look, Dave, if you're going to really survive this, what you're going to have to recognize is that you can only deal with the things you can deal with.
That's because building a pipeline quickly was one thing. Building this particular pipeline quickly was quite another. It had to stretch clear across to the biggest U.S. state. It had to survive earthquakes, and it had to traverse hundreds of miles of permafrost while carrying oil at 180 degrees Fahrenheit. It ultimately took about 70,000 workers to finish the pipeline.
Ben Holman was one of the guys who helped move the 93 million cubic yards of earth it took to build the pipeline.
We were dirt people. We were building pads. We were miners. We were mining gravel.
And the dirt people were under pressure to work fast, too. Holman says at one point he worked 14 weeks straight.
You know, I was so busy doing my thing that I sometimes didn't see the world revolving around me.
It wasn't hard to lure people north to work on the pipeline. The rest of the country was in a recession, and the pay was insane. Some welders and truckers were doing so much overtime, they were paid well over $1,000 a week. A decent salary in today's dollars and a windfall in the 1970s. People came from all over the United States. Texas, Oklahoma, Montana, Tennessee. They were sent to specially constructed camps along the pipeline route. At peak construction, more than 28,000 people were working on the pipeline at once, more than the number of people who were living in the state's capital.
All these workers needed to be housed, fed, and transported to the right job site at the right time every day. It was a logistical nightmare. The man in charge, Haugen's boss, Frank P. Moulin, Jr.
He was absolutely no nonsense. He worked beyond the 7/12s. No vacations, no time off, no holidays, no nothing.
Moulin was a man who believed in the pipeline. He likened it to the Panama Canal or the Great Wall of China. He got to the office at 6 a.m. before any of his employees and stayed there for at least the next 14 hours. Moulin expected the same of everyone below him. A 1976 magazine profile quoted him saying to an employee, "Your wife had a baby? So what?" Six sections of the pipeline were built simultaneously by five different contractors. So Moulin started a competition, tracking their progress with pictures of jockeys and racehorses on a chart.
With everything moving so fast, things inevitably went wrong. At one point, a group of inspectors charged with x-raying the welds in the pipeline couldn't keep up with the welders and started faking the x-rays. When this came to light, it was a huge scandal. Alyeska had to dig thousands of holes around already buried portions of the pipeline to re-inspect the welds. Another massive obstacle was to get the pipeline over a ridiculously steep portion of the Chugach mountain range called Thompson Pass. It was a job that would set a mountaineer's teeth on edge. They attached cables to bulldozers, like marionette strings on giant puppets, just to keep them from tumbling down the slope.
Here, special construction techniques were needed to ferry equipment, pipe, and backfill material up the long slopes, as steep as 45 degrees.
Even Mother Nature was no match for Alyeska's demanding schedule. Planes bombed the mountain pass with coal dust in spring to speed up snowmelt. By winter of 1976, all 800 miles of pipe were laid, including at Thompson Pass. The project was almost finished.
But also by that time, the pipeline's cost had ticked up. At the beginning, the company's estimate was $900 million. Now, Alyeska thought the cost was closer to $8 billion. It was, well, let's let Gladys Knight say it.
That's a whole lot of money, y'all.
That's a whole lot of money, y'all.
At $8 billion, Alyeska went way over budget. And the more the pipeline costs to build, the less money the state would get in royalties. So the state demanded an investigation of Alyeska's spending. To do this, they would need a team with big-time law experience. Someone like Mary DiOrio and Mark Lakritz.
Ironically, our first date was June 17, 1972, which is also the night of the Watergate break-in, which was what the event that brought us to Washington.
Today, they're retired with six grandkids. 45 years ago, they were working on Watergate for legendary investigator Terry Lenzner, who eventually helped take down President Nixon. Then the Trans-Alaska Pipeline case came along. Representing the state of Alaska, DiOrio and Lakritz were dated to Alyeska's Goliath. And Big Oil wasn't eager to cooperate. But then an anonymous source tipped them off to monthly cost reports Alyeska was getting, and that changed everything.
In fact, I can remember one of the documents specifically said, "You better destroy this."
Yes.
"You better destroy this after reading it, just so nobody can sort of see how messed up this project is."
The oil companies wanted the pipeline built yesterday, and they were ready to do whatever it took at whatever the cost to make that happen.
There was very little consideration given to how to do this at the lowest cost. There was nothing, everything was geared toward, you know, hurry, hurry, hurry.
It was a penny pincher's nightmare. When the team added up the unnecessary spending, the total was $1.5 billion, nearly a fourth the cost of the total project. DiOrio says that the need for speed was the root of the ballooning cost of the pipeline.
Their own internal audit made it very clear that they were out of control. They needed to bring in some controls, but they couldn't.
When the investigator's report finally came out, all 700 pages of it, Alyeska pushed back hard. The company said the project's massive complexity and scale made normal cost-cutting efforts impossible. Even today, pipeline defenders criticize the report, saying, "Look, the pipeline lasted more than a decade longer than expected. Sure, it was $8 billion, but it's brought in a lot more money than that." And for 40 years, some version of this fight has been playing out in courts.
Besides the hefty price tag, there were other costs. Subtle, mostly invisible, but incredibly deep. See, The Trans-Alaska Pipeline changed Alaska. There were people who believed that all that pipe on the ground was the death of the real Alaska, but there were also people who saw it as a birth. When first oil flowed down from Prudhoe Bay, the flatline of the state's economy finally picked up a pulse of jobs and money for roads and towns and schools. But that promise of money put extreme pressure on the people who were building the pipeline. And if it really was the birth of Alaska, it was a rough labor. Diane Benson was a Teamster, one of the first female tractor-trailer drivers who worked on the pipeline. Even now, decades later, she knows the pipeline haul road like the back of her hand.
Oh, this is a really good hill here. This is a bad, bad hill. This hill used to make me sweat.
It's still a tough drive. Cracked asphalt and gravel, impossibly steep in some places, muddy in others. Heavy trucks flying down the road shoot gravel in all directions. It is nearly impossible to find a rental car company in the state that will allow you to drive the haul road. And we figured out why pretty quickly.
There you go.
Saw that one coming. That was a big rock.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
Benson was 20 years old in the winter of 1974 when she landed at her first man camp on the steel skeleton of what would become the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. She joined the thousands of people rushing north, looking for work and better pay than any other job you could get in Alaska. Every day she'd get her assignment, tie down her load, then haul supplies between camps and job sites. And a lot of people were putting in these insanely long hours, sometimes in sub-zero temperatures, weeks at a time in darkness. They'd get squirrely, and sometimes they'd get violent. For the women working on the line, the sexual innuendo could turn into harassment very, very quickly.
There's no security. There is no protection.
Benson says it was relentless. She never got a break. But there were a lot of good memories, too. There were days when it was so hot that all she wanted to do was lay outside in the middle of nowhere and soak up some sun. Naked.
Yeah, Alyeska helicopter came flying over us. We went scrambling.
Benson says she is proud of it, proud of the job she did.
It's fun to look at the pipe and look at every segment of what is used to hold it up and know that I hauled every single one of those kinds of things.
For the people working on the pipeline, it was kind of like a war effort. And like people who fought in a war, workers collected mementos. Take Stephen Cordova. He was working in Valdez in 1977, at the very end of the pipeline when oil finally started flowing. He could hear the force of it pushing gas out a vent in the pipe, a vent located right by his bedroom window.
And for a week or better, I heard this vent just going and going. You go to sleep and you listen to this thing, you know, all night long. Then all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, it goes, and I just woke up and I went, oil's in.
It was around 11 p.m. on Thursday, July 28th. Cordova reacted to the pipeline's first oil like a kid waking up at Christmas.
I got dressed really quick, grabbed a gallon jug, ran up to the meter station. Sure enough, here comes the oil. I said, can I have a gallon? They went, yeah. So I got one of the gallons of the first crude that came down the pipeline.
For our trip up the haul road, Diane Benson insists on wearing the same faded yellow Peterbilt hat and silver belt buckle she wore while she was driving trucks decades ago. She's got this 42-year-old picture of herself in that hat in front of a white Peterbilt truck that she adored. She also has 42 years of hindsight. It's one of those things that she's intensely proud of on the one hand.
And a little disturbed by it on another.
And maybe Benson's bittersweet memories of the pipeline reflect the larger legacy of it. It was a death and a birth for the state.
It's impossible now to try and do a cost-benefit analysis of the pipeline. It was extravagantly expensive, but it brought in billions in royalties and dragged rural Alaska into a cash economy.
It changed the social and political landscape of the state. But the total cost? Well, that's something that Alaskans are still struggling to define. And even if it isn't around forever, the pipeline's legacy is nearly $60 billion locked up in a savings account called the Permanent Fund.
Next time on Midnight Oil, how Alaska decided to give a slice of its oil money every year to every man, woman, and child in the state. There are plenty of oil states in the world, but Alaska is the only one that cuts an annual dividend check to its residents. We'll talk to the architects and managers of Alaska's massive oil savings account.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Midnight Oil. Our story was edited by Annie Feit and Jennifer Pemberton and mixed by Dave Waldron. James Glaze composed our theme music. We had help from Annie Ropeek, Nick Jansen, and Dermot Cole. Our media producer extraordinaire is Eric Keto. He interviewed a few of the folks who live and work along the pipeline today. This week, he'll introduce you to Larry Hack Hackenmiller, a bartender turned club owner during the booming bar scene of 1970s Fairbanks. Check out that video and more at alaskapublic.org. I'm Zoe Sobel.
I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh.
And I'm Rasha McChesney.
And I'm Lori Scandling, and welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. With me in the studio is Dana Herndon. She is with the Juno Rotary Club. She is co-chair of the upcoming Brewfest that's set for September 23rd. And the proceeds will help Housing First. And Maria Levachuk is here with us. She is the executive director of the Glory Hole, and she's been the project manager of the Housing First project. Let's start by first describing what Housing First is for those who might not have that background, Maria. And thank you for being here. I know the project's about to open in just a few weeks.
It is. Thanks so much for having us. And so Juno Housing First Collaborative Project is 32 units of permanent supportive housing, which will house our most vulnerable folks. So folks who have severe emergency service usage, have severe alcohol problems, and have been homeless on average of 9.5 years.
So essentially Juno's longest living street people then,
yes.
Those who have been on the street the longest.
Yes.
And when is the facility expected to open?
So our grand opening is on September 20th. We're really hoping to get a few folks in there before then.
And how is it decided who amongst our homeless population would qualify for one of the 32 units?
So the Glory Hole, together with the Juno Police Department, City and Borough of Juno, the hospital, the Juno Alliance for Mental Health, and actually I'm just not going to name all the partner agencies, but there were many partner agencies who participated, conducted a survey. And so it was called the Vulnerability Index Survey. And we did one in 2012, 2015, and this was the third one in 2017. And people were scored based on their vulnerability score, which is how medically fragile they are, how much they use emergency services, their interactions with the criminal justice system, and length of homelessness. And so the folks, the 32 folks who are moving into Housing First, were chosen based on length of homelessness and those scores by the participating agencies.
This is the fourth Housing First project in Alaska. What
is
the intent of Housing First? Is it to save public dollars?
It's saving public dollars is definitely one of the intents. And I think the other intent is to just give people a home so that people can live with dignity. And so in addition to improving the community by saving money on emergency services, you're also just giving somebody a home who has not had a home and over 9 years. We had one person who hasn't had a home in over 30 years.
And these folks can stay in these units as long as they choose.
Permanent, supportive. Yep.
Permanent and supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome, Dana.
Thank you.
You are the co-chair of the Brewfest. How many years has the Juno Rotary been hosting the Brewfest?
So this is our sixth year doing it.
I know it's popular. And it sells out, right?
Yeah. It sells out days before. Well, we sell out the general tickets the day of the event, but the VIP tickets definitely sell out beforehand.
So we're talking September 23rd. That's a Saturday, and it will be at the Jack. What is involved in the Brewfest? Is it just beer, or?
Well, we have tons of beer. We have brewers from all over the state that come. But there's tons of music, too, and food. So it's a really fun event. So it's a great community event, too, and we love our charity partners, and we're very excited to be with partnering with Housing First this year.
We should clarify for our audience that there are four Rotary mm-hmm. clubs in Juneau,
yes.
and we all support each other. This particular event is sponsored by the Juneau Rotary, the longest time Rotary in Juneau. It's been around over 80 years.
Yes.
And all four Rotaries went in together to get what's called a district grant to support the Housing First project
it's
in
so
terms
exciting.
Of purchasing the beds and quilts and shower curtains.
And mattresses.
And mattresses.
New mattresses.
It will make a difference. Dana, how much has the Brew Fest raised in the past that you've been able then to forward to other organizations that are charitable?
Definitely a few thousand. Yeah.
And
I don't know the exact numbers, though, but definitely it's a substantial amount.
And what is the cost for tickets? You did mention that the VIP tickets sell out and that often the regular tickets do a few days before mm-hmm. as well. Talk to us about the cost.
Sure. So we have three different tiers. The general one is a $35 drinking ticket, and you get your own little collectible glass. And then the VIP is $60, and that allows you to come into the Brewfest earlier than everyone else. And then there's a $10 designated driver non-drinking ticket. So you can still come if you don't like beer.
It seems like that ought to be free for somebody who wants to drive
right.
other people. Of course, now we have Uber and Lyft as well as mm-hmm. our taxi services here in town. What time does the event occur on the 23rd at the Jack? Is this an evening event, I assume?
Well, it's during the day, actually. So it starts at 1 and it ends at 5. So, yeah, it's like an afternoon kind of thing.
What are some of the other projects that the downtown Juneau Rotary has supported in the past with the Brewfest proceeds?
So last year we did we supported the heroin, the Stop Heroin group. I'm not entirely sure what the name is. Yeah, it changes every single year. This is my first year, actually, my first full year in Rotary and my first year doing Brewfest, so it's pretty exciting.
What have been some of the organizational challenges you faced if this is your first year as an organizer? Can you give us a peek into pulling off an event? Because
yeah.
those of us who attend these things, we walk in and take it for granted that
yeah.
it's all ready to go.
Well, it's pretty great. We have a really solid steering committee. So and the people in the steering committee have been doing this since the beginning of Brewfest. So they're kind of just showing me the ropes on what's been done before, and luckily I do have an event experience, so it's kind of just like seeing what the timeline is and executing it so that everything is good to go on game day.
And is there a tasting event that's part of that might be competitive, or what are some of the specific activities that are occurring that afternoon?
So we have 11 brewers and maybe more to come from around the state, actually three distributors and then the rest are brewers. And then you do get tastes from like small pours from each one, and I'm pretty sure you can drink as much as your heart desires. And then we do have a lot of food, too, to kind of soak up the beer. So we have Spinning Pig and V Cellar Door and the Pizza Place, Forno Rosso. So we do have food with that.
A food selection. Mm-hmm. And where can people find tickets? Do they have to buy them from a Rotary member, or are there outlets where tickets can be purchased?
So definitely visit the website. It's capbrewfest.com, and then also you can like Capital City Brewfest on Facebook, and there's a ticket link there too.
Mm-hmm. And we should let our audience know that Rotary's worldwide mantra is service above self, and
absolutely.
Ultimately that's what it is about. We're talking with Dana Herndon of the Juneau Rotary, and they are preparing to launch the 6th annual Brewfest. That's September 23rd. That's a Saturday. It'll be in the afternoon between 1 and 4 at the Jack, and there are various levels of ticket prices, which you can find at capbrewfest.com. And Maria Lovichuk, who is the executive director of the Glory Hole, is talking to us about Housing First. How long did this project take to come to fruition, Maria?
This project took a long time to come to fruition. It's been in the planning / pre-development / development / construction phases for about 5 years. So it's really great to see a building.
And were you sold on this concept of providing housing to perhaps some of the most intractable inebriates? What did you think about that as the manager of the Glory Hole when you first heard of the
proposal? I thought it was the worst idea ever. I thought it would never work. It would be terrible. And then we saw how the projects work in Seattle and in Minnesota, and it became very clear that they do work.
What turned you around as a person who works with those who are homeless? What convinced you?
I think just educating myself about other projects around the country, reading a lot of literature, talking to Bill Hobson, who is considered the father of Housing First on the West Coast, and just seeing the projects and then seeing the difference in the people who just been in Housing First for a year. The difference is pretty incredible.
And the opening is September 20th.
September 20th, and everybody is welcome to come. It's at 11:30.
And where is the facility, Maria?
So I actually know what the address is now. It's great. It's,
19, you have a street number.
Yes, it took a while. It's 1944 Allen Court.
Allen Court. And is that in Lemon Creek?
It is.
Okay.
It is. Great sun exposure.
Great sun exposure. We're appreciating that today, especially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're talking with two community members about projects that are happening right close to each other. Again, the Juno Brewfest, Capital City Brewfest, is the 23rd of September, and 3 days before that, the Housing First project, to which proceeds will be donated, will have an opening at 11:30 in the morning at 1944 Allen Court. Thank you both for your work.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 8th of August, 2017. It's the birthday of the physicist Ernest O. Lawrence, born in Canton, South Dakota, 1901. Curious child, as a little boy, he tried to figure out how matches worked, and he ended up lighting his clothes on fire. He built gliders, he built a radio transmitting station, worked his way through college, University of South Dakota, University of Minnesota, went to Yale, accepted a position at the University of California, Berkeley, where he put in 70-hour weeks at the Berkeley Radiation Lab and invented a machine, the cyclotron, to accelerate particles and hurl them at atoms, to smash the atoms open, allowing scientists to discover radioactive isotopes of elements and sometimes new elements. 1899, on this date, the first refrigerator was patented. Before that, people used ice boxes, a little wooden box lined with tin, insulated with cork or sawdust. But Albert T. Marshall came along and got a patent from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And in 1918, the Frigidaire Company was founded to manufacture home refrigerators. The market grew in the 20s and 30s, and then by the end of World War II, no modern kitchen was without one. It's the birthday of the novelist Valerie Sayers, born in Beaufort, South Carolina, 1952, best known for her novel The Powers, about Joe DiMaggio as he sets out on his historic hitting streak in 1941. She grew up in South Carolina, but her father was a Yankees fan. Valerie Sayers' advice to young writers is, have some fun, what the hell. It's the birthday of Sarah Teasdale, 1884, St. Louis, Missouri. She moved to Chicago. She fell in with the Poetry Magazine crowd, Harriet Monroe and Vachel Lindsay, who was in love with her. She was famous for her simple love poems, but she didn't want to marry Vachel Lindsay. She married a businessman from St. Louis. They lived in New York City, unhappy marriage. She divorced him, lived alone for the rest of her life in an apartment just two blocks from the one where she'd lived on Central Park West. And it's the birthday of Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, Washington, D.C., 1896. Lived in Cross Creek, Florida, where she wrote her best-known book, The Yearling, which was the best-selling book of 1938, story of Jody Baxter, farm boy, and his adopted deer. Recognized now as a young adult novel, but popular at the time among a general audience. Here's a poem for today by Paul Hostofsky, The New Criticism. My stepdaughter says I'm boring. Everything you say is boring and like so 70s. Her mother says I'm wonderful, though. She's being fresh. Don't listen to her, she says. But I can't help listening because I want to be fresh and not boring. And I want to say like my stepdaughter because everything is like something, not exactly, but sort of. And she's so contemporary and provocative and, like, alive. She knows all the new neologisms and would never use neologism in a poem, like, ever. A poem by Paul Hostovsky, The New Criticism, from Is That What That Is, published by Future Cycle Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And thanks for staying with us this afternoon on a Juno afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, this afternoon's host. My final guests today are Andrew Bogar. He is the Southeast Alaska Disaster Specialist for the Red Cross, and Michelle Brown, who is the Emergency Programs Coordinator for our city. And we're going to be talking about the Safety and Preparedness Expo, which is in about 5 weeks from now. So what kinds of folks do you want to present at the expo? What's the key messages and pieces of information that you want to get across, Michelle?
Well, it's a Safety and Preparedness Expo. And so we are wanting to have fun, interactive ways to teach the public how they can be prepared so that if they find themselves in a boating accident where they're in the water or something like that, they will have thought ahead of time and be trained and prepared to deal with it. Won't just be things like that, but could be earthquakes, it could be other things, but we want to have this expo be fun. So we want people who are willing to come in, do presentations, tell us stories, and make the event memorable and a fun way to learn.
And certainly a hands-on opportunity is something kids will remember, too. And it
right.
seems if that's a practice that one can instill in a younger person, it's more than likely to stay with them as they
yes.
grow up.
Yes. And it's also been proven time and again that adults have that same need. And so we're making games and word games and trivia and just all kinds of fun activities that make this the topic that could be horrific if you were in it be mm-hmm. a fun thing so that you remember.
And is this sponsored and hosted by the city?
Yes. It's actually through the LEPC committee, and the funding comes through a state grant to the LEPC, which is Local Emergency Planning Committee. We do it once every other year because it's a very expensive event, and we do not charge the public or the participants as vendors to participate. So
it will be free and open on September 15th and 16th at Centennial Hall. Folks should get that on their calendar. Andrew, as the disaster specialist for Southeast Alaska for the Red Cross, we were chatting a little bit before we went on the air that you've had 14 years military experience as well as your college years in Homeland Security and emergency preparedness. You've got a lot of experience. What can you tell us are the most likely things that people are not prepared for that they ought to be prepared for?
Are not prepared for. That's a curveball. So, because I'm used to everyone who's heard about earthquakes and tsunamis and house fires.
You mentioned renter's insurance,
yeah,
and
renters
there are lots of renters in Juneau because
yes.
our housing's expensive.
Well, regardless of what the disaster is, having renter's insurance is critically important. When you're standing there looking at everything that you used to own, it's still yours. You're emotionally attached to it, but it's no longer, having that renter's insurance will help get you back to what's going to be a new normal. It's going to help with your recovery process. But you asked about an event that most people don't think about, and I would say food security is one of those.
Oh.
About 98% of everything that we consume in Alaska comes from the lower 48. And we've all been to the local grocery stores where a barge has been turned around because of foul weather or a mechanical issue, and you're going, where's the produce? Well, what happens if, one of the communities in Lower 48 that sends us the stuff that we consume experiences an earthquake? Our homes will be fine. You know, our lives would only be minimally disrupted except for the fact, what are we going to eat? And we actually have a community partner that's coming and is going to give a presentation at the expo about what should be in your pantry and how to store those things and how to, you know, first in, first out, rotational basis. There's a lot of good information about stuff like that. And people get wrapped up around the lists upon lists of things that you need. And there's really easy ways of breaking that down on how a family can budget for these things. And it's not about scaring people. It's about letting them be informed so they don't have to be concerned, don't have to be as worried about these events that could be a crisis.
Michelle, you were emphasizing this is about preparedness. It's not about stressing emergencies, but in fact preparedness. What is the city's role in this, in making sure that its citizens are prepared for everything from the challenges of being out on the water to living in an earthquake-active area?
Right. As emergency programs, we have the responsibility to do the planning for our city and for our people. And the community reaches out to us and will come in and do trainings, like we've done trainings to the senior centers about, I get calls that say, who's going to come take care of me if there's an emergency? And they're afraid. They're vulnerable. And they need to be taught in a manageable way that they can bite off, that they can be prepared, and that empowers them. Preparedness for safety, preparedness for emergencies, empowers a person to be able to take control and not be afraid and do the right actions.
And what do you advise those folks who call you? What are two or three specific things that you do recommend to them to be ready?
I recommend that they don't wait for someone else to take care of them, that ahead of time that they reach out to 2-3 neighbors and let them know what their vulnerabilities are, the things that they need a little assistance with. And we're all in that boat. We don't know who might be able to show up at an emergency, because when it strikes, a lot of people might be involved in it and they're no longer available to help. So you want to have backup plans so that when it happens, you know comfortably that you can count on so-and-so to come and assist you, and also how you can and what you need exactly to exit your building if you need to. Do you have a little bit of food on hand, and can you prepare it yourself? That way, you're going to feel comfortable with the timeline that you might have to wait for a first responder to be free enough from the big emergency to start thinking about the people that are vulnerable.
Michelle, where can people give a call or go online to connect with the organizers of the Safety and Preparedness Expo if they would like to be a vendor and like to make a presentation?
Well, Andrew, gratefully, this year raised his hand to be our primary organizer for this event. And it's his first year to organize the event, so we're really excited about his help. And thank you, Andrew. And his phone number is...
So the number we can use is 907-347-5841. You can also email me at andrew.bogar@redcross.org.
We're talking with Andrew. Go ahead, Michelle.
And I can be reached at 586-0371. That's Michelle Brown. And lots of folks out there have contacted me for other events, so you're familiar.
If you know of someone or you yourself would like to present and help our community understand how to be prepared for any number of safety challenges that may arise, you can call Michelle Brown at the city, 586-0371, or contact Andrew, who's with the Red Cross, at 907-347-5841.
One more thing, too, we're looking for food vendors that have their own trailer that might be interested in coming and doing an outside vendor of food this year. So if you're interested, give us a call.
All right. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
¶¶